Hello, and a warm welcome to Upper Bottom, a refreshingly light-hearted sobriety podcast, taking an ambivalent look at giving up boozing for people who haven't hit rock bottom. My name's Ollie.
Hey, I'm Tess. We both gave up drinking in early 2023, and we found that our friends were so curious about sobriety journeys, we decided to start this podcast.
Yeah, that's right. Expect a splash of wisdom, a shot of honesty, and a chaser of curiosity each week as we feature embarrassing drinking tales, unusual observations, and expert interviews to try and make sense of sobriety.
So, for anyone rethinking their relationship with alcohol, please join us on Upper Bottom. We're living proof that getting sober doesn't have to be a bum deal.
Cheers!
Hello and welcome to a special St. George's Day edition of Upper Bottom. How are you doing, Ollie?
Pretty good. Quite excited that it's St. George's Day. I don't think I've really ever celebrated it, though.
No?
It's not the sort of thing that I've celebrated. Have you celebrated? Well, I suppose you used to in the pub, so maybe there was, it was a bit of a...
Yeah, I'm be careful what I'm going to say here, but in my experience, the kind of pubs that have the cross of St. George displayed prominently on St. George's Day, the kind of pubs I tend not to go into.
Yes.
Sorry for being England-hating, metropolitan, liberal. But that's generally how I feel.
Well, we're going to be talking quite a lot about St. George's Day today anyway, and pubs.
He was a Turk anyway.
Well, yeah, apparently so.
If such a thing as a Turk lived in that part of the world then. But yeah, he certainly wasn't English.
Well, no. Well, we dig into a little bit more of that. We've got, we're speaking to Rupert Ponsonby.
He's definitely English.
He's a lovely English gent, isn't he?
Yeah.
With some fantastic insights. How was your weekend? You had a busy weekend, didn't you? You had a birthday. We went to a gig on Friday together. That was great, wasn't it?
Yeah. Nightmares on Wax, reliving the halcyon days.
With an orchestra.
Yeah, it was great, wasn't it? North Festival Hall.
Sit-down affair.
Mm.
No, and I've recently been to quite a few gigs, your gig included the other week, and I found it just so enriching. And previously, I suppose, I'd be well lubricated when attending gigs. And I've just been really conscious recently. I mean, I know Friday's thing at the Royal Festival Hall was a sit-down affair. Mm. But the last two or three times I've been out where it hasn't been, where it's been a stand-up affair, I felt really conscious of dancing. And I went to see a Brazilian guy, Jojo Strauss, and I was there with a couple of pals, finished my non-alcoholic bottle, went to the bar, and then I kind of wanted to dance but felt as though I needed to put my hands in my pocket, so I actually went and ordered myself another bottle just so I could have a prop. That's sad, isn't it? I need to get over this.
I mean have you overcome the kind of the awkwardness now of listening to music without a drink?
Definitely,
yeah.
I'm just more self-conscious of my bad dancing.
Oh, that's a shame. Yeah, I don't know. It's a funny one, isn't it? I think we're so... But, you know, there are certain dance floors where it's very frowned upon to have a beer on the dance floor, isn't it?
Well, the Northern Soul affairs
very
that we've been to recently.
You'd be more than tutted. You'd be...
Oh, yeah.
If you had a bottle with...
Yanked
you.
Off the dance floor.
Do you remember smoking on the dance floor?
Yes.
I used to come home with, like, burn holes and...
Oh, yeah.
Nice cashmere jumpers and all sorts.
Yeah. Just someone brushing against you, and there you go. There's your new shirt up in flames.
Yeah. So that's dancing. Well, I just think it's one of these things. It takes time.
Do you feel self-conscious? More self-conscious than before?
I haven't been able
to really let myself go. I mean, there's been so many occasions in the past when I think where I've, you know, certainly... Quite a few years ago now, it has to be said, but got up on the stage, got up on the, I don't know, platforms and just danced and really felt in the rhythm. But I've not felt that since I've stopped drinking, which is a bit of a shame.
Well, we need to get some kind of dance tutor.
I feel that's a bridge I need to get across.
Mm. I think it's one of these things where you just, mentioned it before, but you've just got to commit. Once your BPM, once the BPMs are there and once your heart rate is up, then it sort of becomes self-propagating. But I think with all these things, it's that first bit that's easier to do with a few drinks. But once you're up and running, almost literally, because you're used to running, you're used to kind of being in that zone, I think then that will help.
I must say, Friday at the Royal Festival Hall, sat down, roasty, very conscious as well of people. I think we were there for an hour and a half. How many people were getting up, going to the bar, then going to the loo, coming back?
I know.
There was a stream of people, and I just felt myself getting kind of a little bit frustrated and irate, actually, about it.
Those guys, there was a guy in front of us that was pretty wide-eyed as well.
Yeah.
I was looking at him, and he kept leaning over and chatting. And I mean, not that the noise was a problem for me, but I was in two minds. There was a bit of me that was thinking, I wonder what time he started. But then there's another bit of me thinking, oh, he doesn't look like he's having quite a lot of fun, though.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, thanks to DJ Ease.
Yeah, yeah. What else? Marathon. Did you tune into the marathon yesterday?
No. I mean, we did our little,
trot, didn't we?
But no, was it good? Did you watch any of it?
I didn't watch any. I love it, though. I love the marathon. I think it's just such a great thing. And I wonder, I mean, the times that I've done it, I have abstained from drinking about a month before or so. And I just sort of think that you are thrust. I think they used to give you a beer in the kind of goodie bag that you get. And just that first beer, it just sort of goes straight. You know, it tastes great.
Yeah.
But you just feel very lightheaded afterwards. And I think there's a sort of celebration element there that involves drinks.
I went to Go Ape on Saturday morning for Siggy's birthday, which is very good, by the way. Really enjoyed that. But I was at Battersea Park, which is a park I don't know very well. And there was loads of people running in, you know, expensive running gear because you're in, you know, most part of town there. And I said to my wife, do you think more people run now than they used to? And I couldn't work out whether they did or whether it's sort of a late developing runner of sorts. I just noticed
more conscious of it. Yeah.
Well, you know, to be honest, I wouldn't be out at 9 o'clock on a Saturday.
Well, there is that as well, isn't there? Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think more people are running?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think lockdown, from what I've read and seen, helped with a bit of that. People wanted to get out and about a bit more and caught the running bug a bit more.
Yeah.
I think the same is true for cycling as well. I think generally we are, you know, more health conscious.
Yeah. I was recommended a podcast all about dopamine the other day, which I will check out and share with you and the listeners. But yeah, basically making the point that we're all sort of dopamine addicts of one sort of another. And there are just different ways of obtaining that natural high, cycling and running obviously being two.
Well, I think that's definitely true. And I think in this world of social media and smartphones, you know, lots of people get their dopamine hits that way. I must say, I have felt much better, considerably better, since I deleted X and Facebook. Haven't missed it at all. But I think I think I've gone a step a bit too far because I've now got an ice bath.
Well, you're clearly looking at something online.
I was pestered on Instagram, I think. And I've been gifted it, basically. One of these Lumi ones. And I'm not very good with cold water. My heart, I kind of do that, which apparently is the worst thing you can do when you go into cold water. And you apparently lead up to actually having a dunk in the ice bath. Over a month, you just have cold showers and you kind of turn it up or down rather over a period of time. I'm now on about 20 seconds of cold.
Pretty cold, right? And if you checked out Wim Hof,
well, he's the kind of the leader, isn't he? He's the granddaddy of the lot, and that comes from grief.
That's
you know,
right. Yeah.
He only really got into it through. So it's his pain is quite beautiful, actually.
Yeah. He's an engaging chap, isn't he? Have you tried the breathing exercises as well?
Well, no, I need to do that because even in the shower just before, I was kind of felt myself going a bit like that.
We will report back.
Yes, so I feel as though it might be a step too far. I don't know.
So, St. George's Day, what have we got? Topical.
Booze news. There's some great ideas for mocktails here from our friends Dry Drinker. We had Stuart Elkington, founder of Dry Drinker, on a few weeks ago, and they sent out something in their newsletter. Did you know, Cess, that there is a traditional St. George's Day drink called Dragon's Blood. I'm just quoting here now. This crimson-coloured cocktail is made with a combination of gin, cherry liqueur, and cranberry juice. giving it a rich and vibrant flavour. That sounds very refreshing, actually, doesn't it?
That's quite...
quite punchy as well. Mm-hmm. Bit of fire. And then they've come up with a few mocktails, which sound great, actually. I'm going to read out three of them here. One's called Dragon's Breath.
Well, we'll have that.
Especially after too many dragon's bloods. Yeah, anyway, Dragon's Breath. Spicy and feisty, this rich and juicy firecracker concoction will honour you with the bravery of a saint. And, yeah, hint of black pepper, cayenne pepper and flames. The next one is Rose of England. This is delicate daytime cocktail, mocktail, I suppose. Touch of rose water paired with seedlip herbs. And yeah, that sounds delightful, actually. I can imagine having a little drink of that on a nice summer's day quite soon.
Probably about 20 quid a bottle.
Yeah, maybe. Greenfields of England. You make these. These are things you make. And there are actually instructions on the Dry Drinker website. I think it's on their blog. And the last one I'm going to mention is Greenfields of England, an eloquent mocktail with hints of green tea and sage and a slight white foam that dances across fields of pale green grass hues. Doesn't sound as appealing to me, that one.
No, I'm going to go for the tea.
I think I might quite rather look at the Rose of England. Anyway, check those out on the Dry Drinker website. And what have you got for us, Cess?
So I have got the nine most famous... I don't know why they said nine, not ten, but the nine most famous...
That's for SEO. They always do that. If you get a round number, it's less appealing, apparently.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's why you often get five or seven or, right, in this case, nine.
This was in the Morning Advertiser trade publication for publicans and all things pub-related. But the nation's favourite pub has been revealed thanks to new research from insurance provider Simply Business. So, Ollie...
Nation's favourite pub.
Favourite pub, yeah.
Favourite TV pub.
Well, I think, yeah. So these are kind of... It says Nation's favourite pub, so...
Okay.
What would you say would be the number one?
I mean, it's got to be the Queen Vic in EastEnders. Mm. Oh, no. Okay.
If it's not that one...
Well, it's got to be the Rover's Return. Is
I
it
was going to say.
That's in Coronation Street, right?
You know, it's... You're from out that way. Where's your regional bias? I thought you would have gone for Coronation Street straight away.
Too assimilated down south now.
So Queen Vic number two. Number three, only down the road.
Struggling.
The Nag's Head.
The Nag's Head.
Only Fools and Horses.
Of course, the Peckham Boys.
Yeah, exactly. And four, this is strange, because this is, how can this be Britain's top TV pubs when it's Moe's Tavern in The Simpsons? Number five, the Garrison Pub at Peaky Blinders.
Yeah, okay.
That looks like they'll have some good nights in there, don't they?
Yeah, well, they did. And
you wouldn't want to work on the door, though, would you?
No, probably not. There's probably some fisticuffs every now and again.
Yeah. But there we go. And there's Emmerdale, the Wallpack. I've been there. I've been to that pub.
Have you?
It's a real pub, yeah.
Whereabouts is that one, then? Is it sort of...
It is around the back of somewhere. Bradford Way, I think.
Yeah. Right, okay.
Yeah. No, it's nice. And there's some there that I don't even know. Paddy's Pub, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and McLaren's Pub in How I Met Your Mother. Don't know those TV shows. But yeah, the nation's favourite pub. So that's interesting. And also...
What would you say your favourite pub...
Ever?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good question, isn't it? Oh. I'd say in terms of... There's lots of different subcategories, but one I walked past the other day, in terms of looking pub, I'm a big fan of the Blackfriars.
Yeah. I had my pre-wedding drink there.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
It's such a strange shape as well. It's sort of triangular.
Yeah, it's almost like iron shaped, isn't it? Flat iron shape. But yeah, that's in Blackfriars with lots of lovely Art Nouveau sort of friezes and stuff, I suppose you call it. I mean, going back...
The pre-wedding pint, I could hardly drink.
Were you nervous?
I must have been. Yeah. I've never had a problem with drinking a pint before. And I just couldn't really get it. I suppose I was a little bit hungover. But yeah, it was such a weird feeling. Where did you have your kind of pre-wedding?
We got married in Sweden, so we kind of provided the bar. And we'd just been to the Systembolaget and stocked up. But yeah, that's a nice looking pub. I spent a lot of time in the Good Mixer in the 90s, which is a horrible pub to look at, but some good memories inside. And Filthy McNasties. Had some nights in there. Used to be a barman there. So I kind of guess I'm a bit biased to the pubs that I've kind of worked in or
had so much to do with. It's the kind of pubs you know, isn't it? We used to live up in the northwest of London, and there was a beautiful pub near Warwick Avenue called Prince Alfred. And it was a very old pub insofar as it had different sections. And you had to sort of get your pint, duck under. And it had beautiful glass frontage. Curved glass. And again, some great memories there.
I just thought of a really good one in Dorset, actually, which is called the Square and Compasses. So that doesn't even have a bar. It just has like, it's like a cave, has a hole in the side of this ancient building where they kind of get your beer from inside. Played there once. That's in Worth Matravers. Yeah, that's a pretty special pub as well.
Do you think they'd serve non-alcoholic, low-alcoholic?
I think they'd turn their nose up at that. Be a dusty bottle of Heineken Zero. They might find for you.
Warm, yeah. Well, that's interesting. Let us know your favourite pubs, I guess. Yeah, I'd be interested to know. So my next item of booze news this week was in the Daily Mirror. Vinnie Jones, the footballer, rough footballer turned rough actor. I think he's in The Gentleman. Have you seen The Gentleman on Netflix?
I'm aware of it, yeah. He's got
a Guy Ritchie thing. Yeah, they've got a good connection, haven't they? Anyway, he was talking in The Mirror about celebrating 11 years of sobriety, which I was surprised about. I didn't actually know he was sober. And, he was obviously known as a hard man on and off the pitch. And the 59-year-old says for his birthday, for the milestone, he'll be chilling out. And there's some great quotes in this piece. He says, "I'm enjoying the joy in life. I think I've learned a little bit that ego is not your amigo." But specific to this podcast, there's another line that he uses later on. And he says, "Yes, you can have a few pints because you're in your 20s and you can run it off and you can get away with it. But drinking is a young man's sport." Mm. And I don't know, that kind of resonated with me, I think. Not because I was suffering from, significant hangovers, but yeah, I don't know. I just feel as though...
You put away childhood things.
A little bit. I don't know if it's maturity or whatever, but I'm kind of happy with where I am now. To give an idea of how, I suppose, alcohol changed Vinny's life or caused him to act badly, he was arrested in 1997 for beating his neighbour drunkenly and convicted of assault and criminal damage. And the following year, he bit a journalist's nose right down to the bone. And 2003, he was given a community service for assaulting a passenger on a flight to Japan. I'm just adding that because I know our listeners like a bit of grit. But anyway, well done on you, Vinny, for making 11 years. You're an inspiration.
Yeah. So Abel Wiseman in The Guardian takes a slightly different view on sobriety and drinking habits. So quite by accident, Eva writes, "I found myself almost completely sober. And I mean, yes, right now." And she talks about how that feels. She's had kids recently, et cetera, et cetera. And she makes the point that she's not alone. And there are many people choosing to give up drinking or cut down for reasons of mental, physical health, finances and addiction. But she makes a point that looking out sober as a culture, we are now coming to associate alcohol exclusively with pain. And I feel that we are at risk of forgetting what a truly lovely thing a little bit of booze could be. And she then quickly makes a point to say, is it okay to say this? Is it okay to celebrate the lost art of having a little drink? So I think definitely worth checking out. This was in The Guardian recently. And yeah, she just kind of, I guess, kind of looks back at various parts of her life and some of the good times that she's had with alcohol. And I guess he's making the point that maybe as a culture, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Mm. Yeah. And finally, she proposes we keep a fond place in our hearts for a little drink. Even for getting a little bit drunk, even for getting really quite drunk, actually, and all the chaos and pleasure and terrible decisions and unexplained bruises and mad truths it brings. Now, a year and what is it, four, maybe five months. And a lot of what Ava's sort of saying, I really feel it. It's now so long ago since I've had a hangover.
Mm.
I'm struggling to remember the bad things, if I'm honest. And I've had a cold, like a really horrible cold for the last 2 or 3 weeks, on top of two other colds, which I've had this year. And I think there's one thing about being sober and jumping out of bed in the morning and going for a run and just feeling completely empowered to do all this stuff. But if you're feeling a bit rubbish anyway and you don't have those benefits, I've certainly felt a bit like, what am I doing this for?
Mm.
Who am I trying to prove this to? I prove it to myself. I've succeeded. I've done it. I've got the T-shirt. I've got the podcast. What's
we need the podcast T-shirt now, next.
Yeah, and I just felt that, when I read that piece, it made me quite to
yearn,
yeah, a little bit. It was like, you know, have I, you know, thrown the baby out with the bathwater, and what is it I'm trying to achieve now? And I think it's partly to do with the fact I've not been very well, thankfully, listeners, feeling more like my old self again today. But yeah, I just feel I wonder as a culture whether there is something in what she's saying, because would you go back and erase all of those crazy nights and all of those decisions, bad that though some of them were? So I guess I'm mindful of pontificating too much to my kids about what I don't, the dangers of the demon drink, going back to our temperance chat, when actually I'm still really conflicted about the whole thing.
I certainly wouldn't go back and erase those, you know, great nights out, great days, which have been alcohol-fueled. I mean, they self-erased through the amount of booze that I drank, I think, to an extent. And I think, yeah, I mean, I think I'm still on the fence a little bit as well. I don't think you can be too preachy. And even now, you know, my son will say, oh, I'm never going to, you know, never going to drink.
Mm.
And I said, well, you know, don't be too hasty in saying that, Fred, because I'm sure, you know, there's a lot to enjoy about drinking. I think for me, it feels right still at the moment to continue with sobriety. But I'm never saying never.
No.
And I still do, you know, the sun's shining now. I've got a holiday in France in the summer coming up, and it's a place that I know quite well, and I love the wine there, and there's a spirit there called Ombre, and it's kind of honey aperitif or digestif even. It's really sweet, and it's just nectar. I mean, it's just beautiful, and I still have a yearning for that.
So. I suppose if we were sort of signed up members of AA, we sounds like we need a meeting.
Different, yeah. Well, right? Yeah.
And I can kind of see that, because we live in the world of the boozers, and with the exception of each other.
Mm.
That's the only other non-drinkers that we know. So it can feel sometimes like the rest of the world is going, come on, you've done this now. But yeah, that would be traditionally the time when you'd attend a meeting, right?
Mm.
Kind of get talked out of it. And I did, and I've kind of mocked them on here before a little bit, but there's a drop the bottle thing that jumped up on Insta the other day that said two words to the effect of the relapse happens in your mind a long time before the actual purchase of the drink happens.
Yeah.
So it just made me, but then it made me think, well, quite glad I do still see that stuff that pops up, because it kind of, is that kind of catching me before I fall?
Well, maybe, yeah. There is also, Chris, friend of the pod, was saying that every time he listens to an episode, it makes him thirsty for a beer as well. So I don't know, maybe it's just all this talk. I think there is something, though, about lots of the social media content in that sobriety ecosystem that I find a bit hard to swallow. And yeah, there's a sort of natural reflex to want to kick back against that.
Do you think it's the American listeners, there's a couple of you. Do you think it's quite American, isn't it? It's quite black and white. It's quite censorious in behaviour that I just think for our British, slightly more cynical mindset, we just struggle with. Do you think?
Yeah, I think there's probably something in that, yeah. I mean, this is why we've tried to pitch ourselves very much ambivalent, still working it out.
Yeah.
We're not going to be raving too much.
No.
Or admonishing too much, hopefully.
No. But thanks for the support. I spoke to a listener the other day, and he was telling me about how, in addition to various purchases, his go-to position is a non-alcoholic beer, and he'll change that on certain occasions, which is something entirely new, which is great, right?
It's funny you should say that. I was out with at one of the gigs that I've mentioned, at the Hootenanny, last week, and the guy that I was with, who I didn't know very well, very nice guy, Nick, if he's listening, and he, not out of solidarity, but his go-to is to have a pint and then have a non-alcoholic pint, and he would alternate. I've not seen that before, actually.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, isn't it? That reminds me of a piece, just quickly to round off, that also in the Morning Advertiser. So this was quoted from David McDowell. So David McDowell is the chief executive of the Stonegate Group. So Stonegate Group being the biggest pubco in the country. He was talking about the various changes that they're seeing in terms of people's drinking habits. Mm-hmm. And he says, the sale of non-alcoholic products remains a relatively small proportion of the company's overall revenues, but people's habits are changing significantly. It's really important for us to continue to cater for that trend towards moderation and prove to people that you can still have a non-alcoholic beer or a Coke Zero and still be part of the great pub experience. So I guess when you're seeing people like that make those sort of statements, they're certainly suggesting that the trends that we've been discussing aren't going anywhere soon.
Yeah. Well, on that note, should we get Rupert on?
Yes, let's get Rupert on.
Thank you very much for joining us, Rupert Ponsonby. Would you like to introduce yourself for our listeners, please, Rupert?
I would, but I suppose I'm all sorts of strange, different things. So I am I'm a public relations for booze of all sorts. I'm a farmer. I'm interested in pollination. So I'm hopefully uncategorizable.
Kind of multi-hyphenated. Yes, that's exactly what we love, Rupert. And we've got you on today for our St. George's Day episode in the hope that we can throw around some ideas on St. George's Day, which is obviously all about feasting and drinking and making merry. So perhaps you could fill us in a little bit about England's relationship with booze from your perspective.
Okay. Well, from my perspective, I'm a beer man, really. So from my perspective, luckily, it's all about beer. Probably further back than that is about mead as well. And mead is coming through now again with people called Gosnells who are down in Peckham in London. But in general terms, we were beer people. We had different styles of beer every century or two. So everyone thinks that lager is everything because lager is what is around today. But actually, if you go back in time, in the medieval time, we're into old ales. Before that, with the Saxons, we were into just a liquid which they put herbs and spices into because they didn't know about hops till about 1500. And then you had, obviously, the Saxons came along with their unhopped stuff. And then you had porters, and then you had India Pale Ale, and then you had stout. And now we have lager.
So my understanding that hops came over via Germany. Is that right?
Historically, we worked for all the hop growers here for about 10 years. And historically, I think they came from Flanders, really. There was a boat in the Graveney Marshes going back to about 1200, which had hops in the base of it all. But that probably just went up in a storm. So basically, it's about 1500 Flemish weavers came across this country. And at the same time, hops probably came along as well. And they grew it on tall poles, which they put in the fields, normally in sandy soil down in Kent. And so probably 1500, 1550 is about time when that they all started.
And is that... is that the main difference when we talk about beer versus ale? I know the two terms are quite often used to describe the same thing, but that's not strictly true. Does
Does a beer need to have hops added, Rupert?
No, I don't think it does. But in the early days, they obviously didn't add hops until about 1500. So you had all sorts of spices and bark of a tree in order to give you an edge. Otherwise, the mess of pottage was pretty sweet, and too sweet. So they like to have something else in amongst it, there. And so nowadays, you still, the joy of the hop, as you probably know, is that hop is not just flavour. It's also a preservative. And hops happen to be one of my specialist subjects. So I'm fascinated by the essential oils in each hop. So if you look back sort of 10 years ago, we just talked about hops being high in power or low in power. High in power is high in alpha acid, 10 to 20%. Low in power is 3, 4, 5%. Things like Goldings and Fuggles being 3, 4%. And so if you use them, they're more delicate. And you have to put more in if you want to get a real hoppy flavor. And in the old days, people, we just thought about being either low in alpha, high in alpha, or dual purpose in the middle. But now we're realizing that each hop has its own essential oils. And the important thing is not just the flavor of the essential oils, it's actually that different ones react to heat in the copper in different ways. So some of them, as soon as they see heat, they walk, off they go through the chimney, whereas others don't mind at all, hang around. So it's a real art for the brewers when you put it in. You put a very delicate hop in too early, you'll blow it through the roof, and therefore you get none of the flavor.
Right, and dry hopping, you're the expert here, so please correct me if I'm wrong. Dry hopping is the process that's done when people add the hop flowers to the product after initial fermentation, is that right?
Yeah, or even after the final fermentation. And some people I know, publicans actually put their own little hops into the cask in their own pub. Now, brewers would worry intensely about that. They'd think, here am I as an artist making this blooming wonderful beer, and here's this publican doing their own thing. But every now and again, a publican may like a particular hop, so they can put it in at the last minute, and there you go. So I just think that is so left field and revolutionary, and yet it's so clever flavor-wise.
I love, you mentioned Kent earlier on, I love going to the pubs down in Kent, and quite often you see the hops all around the bar, don't you? It's a real regional speciality they have down there.
Yeah, and then the only basic hops, as you know, probably a member of the cannabis family. There are also some string family as well. And I just think they're the most amazing creatures. We're getting better at learning how to keep the pests away by putting positive bugs in amongst them so as to eat the pests. So we're trying to get away from having to spray things and trying to only spray when we actually need to rather than spraying in advance. But I know you were talking about sort of 0%, et cetera, but the whole thing about 0% is you've got to get the aroma right. And I think aroma is the most fascinating thing. So it's not only hops, but if we look back at things we've done in the past with our company here, we worked with people called Bumpus and Parr, who you probably know, who are mad jelly mongers. They're also the people in Borough Market who had that wonderful Museum of Food and Drink. And we went down to have one of our launches for our Mr. Trotter Pork Scratching Company down in the basement. And they do actually a gin and tonic mistrum. So in the first bit of the mistrum, you can see people from 10 yards away. Second bit of the mistrum from 3 yards away. Third place, you can see the Molesso within 2 feet of you. And so you were just wearing your sort of rubber mac down underneath the ground. These wonderful aromas of gin and tonic all around you. Just aromas, not the flavor, not taste. So, gosh, if we're trying to develop something for the future, maybe our homes ought to be full of gin and tonic mist or whiskey mist.
I love that. I've actually experienced the Bombus and Parr G&T experience. And, yeah, it was quite amazing. Those guys are incredible. One of the things that we've found through our recent interviews is that the drive for non-alcoholic grown-up drinks is actually driving innovation across the piece. Is that what you're finding?
Yes. I mean, I think also it's really clever of beer as a category to actually have more revolutionary new way of ideas than wine has been able to do. I think wine slightly went through a period of sitting back on its heels a bit, whereas beer decided they've got to go it. And so if you think of even the last 10 years, I mean, the number of microbreweries has risen so much. And, you know, luckily way back in 1994, I was brewing beer, so Whitbread. I did one with chocolate in, I did one with gin and tonic in, I did one with myrrh, as in Murray Christmas Ale. And so now people are going far, far further than that as well. But we are really innovating. We're realizing that if you're going to have a 0% alcohol beer, you have to have balance and you have to have body and you have to have aroma. And quite often the hop can cover things over. But if you look at the German wheat beers, the wheat beer character is lovely and sort of sweet and almost like sugar puffs or something. And therefore it covers over the whole, which the alcohol's just gone away, has left.
Brilliant. When one thinks of Old England, and I'm thinking of an image of John Bull that I've got in my head, quite a rotund character, maybe with a hat, and he's often got a pint of ale and maybe some roast beef. How far back does that image of England go, Rupert?
The answer is it goes way back, but in a way people think of beer in Britain as being a male thing. In fact, it wasn't at all. It was really a female thing. It was the Brewster. And if you look at the pub sign outside a pub these days, that actually started, I believe, when women brewed the beer for local consumption. And once they brewed the beer, knowing that it would go off if they left it for too long, particularly if they didn't know about hops, they would then put a branch of a tree outside to say, my beer is ready. And so that has now changed to being a pub sign. But I think the beer and food thing, which I think has been one of the big growth areas of beer, has really taken us to a different level. And I think part of the beer and food thing was, I suppose, realizing the world of wine had got so far ahead of us because they have all their French sommeliers. And even if the sommelier comes from Dagenham, they still have a French accent. And so the world of beer needed to get away from only the wine people having wine lists to have beer lists instead. So we wanted to have a bouquet de beer because we were tasse de vin. Glass of wine, so we always thought we would have a bouquet or a bucket of beer so that a beer sommelier could go around and actually taste the beer. So the image was of beer and food, and it was of hearty British foods, you're right.
Yeah.
And I think now we've taken that a long way further forward because, you know, over the last 10 years people have been pairing beer with sushi, with pies, with puddings, with chocolates, with, you know, all these different foods. And in a way, therefore, as you were saying earlier on, it's taking it beyond the world of wine. Because the world of wine was so far ahead of us. I think now, in a way, the world of beer is probably so far ahead of wine in terms of pairing the foods.
I was interested, you know, yes, there have been this rise of microbreweries in the last decade in particular. How is climate change changing things here in the UK in particular?
It depends on how we sort of define climate change. If you link climate change with this interesting word, sustainability, which I suppose you should, even though sustainability as a word isn't qualified or quantified nearly as much as it should be. I think the industry has realized that you've got to do great things. So, you know, whether people are now looking at B Corp or whatever, whether they're looking at the use of their water, whether they're looking at how far they get their barley from or their wheat from, how much water they use for washing down, where their electricity comes from. So the answer is, like, looking more broadly, I think the whole beer industry is realising that we've actually got to look to the future of the planet, not just to brewing our pint.
Fantastic. And Rupert, you called the trend of 0% beer quite a while ago, didn't you?
Well, the great Jane Parkinson and I were asked to do a Imbibe live show for sommeliers and bartenders, etc., probably about 8 years ago. And we just decided that we wanted to look to the future. And we just thought that 0% would work. Partly, I think, because in Australia, it was already something like 10% even then of beer sales were 0%. And I think Spain was quite good. So we thought, well, if those countries are doing it, and I always think Australia's always prides itself as being so macho, if they can think that it's a good idea, maybe we should as well. So we had beers. We had, I think, Erdinger wheat beer we had. We had Brooklyn Lager. And we had various other beers, and Ghost Ship from wonderful Adnams in Suffolk. And we had about 35 people attending, and it was really interesting that even then things were good, but now they're that much better.
Yes, Ghost Ship's a good one, isn't it? They were doing that quite a long time before some of their competitors, weren't they?
They were. And if you think about how horrible a lot of the 0% and low alcohols were, mentioning no names, even 15 years ago. And I remember giving my children some 0%, and they immediately they knew they were 0%, something wrong. So I think now I'm so excited that, you know, you've got people like Nirvana, you've got people like, you know, you've got people up in Scotland doing great stuff. So suddenly we're realising that actually it's doable.
The English abroad, Rupert, have let us say, a checkered relationship with with booze, I think, certainly in terms of some of our European friends. In your professional opinion, how do we compare to other nations in terms of our drinking habits? Do you think it's fair, this bad reputation that we have?
Yes and no. I think there's a lot of hysteria in the press always about us behaving badly. I think the answer is yes, we do behave badly. I think we behave quite often very crudely and very coarsely. So there's no defence of that. But in terms of the amount of beer we drink, let us say, I think we're only 22nd in the world list. And there was a study recently by a Japanese university, by Stuhl, who said, as we knew, Czech Republic's first, Germany second. And we're only 22nd. But I think you're right. I think every now and again, we're not used to quick volume or quick speed of it all, maybe. And therefore, I think we do let ourselves that.
I was trying to think about some historical references to alcohol, thinking about some Shakespeare plays. I mean, they mentioned wine, Malmsey wine, don't they? And obviously the wine industry goes back to our time in Gascony. So obviously we have a history of drinking wine. But would you say that beer has been the drink of choice for the English, as far as we can ascertain?
I think, yes, it has. But also, interestingly, we have things like sack as well, obviously, which is Shakespeare mentions a lot. But I think that, I think we are a beer nation. We don't really grow grapes. The Romans, when they came here, obviously brought their wine with them, but then they found they couldn't really import enough of it. So they got used to our beer and they started baking. So lots of ruins nowadays, which are excavated, show maltings, malt the barley into. And so they got on the act as well. So, yeah, I think we are a beer nation. Although now I'm really, really excited by all the English wines which are in the market. And I think they are phenomenal. I remember going down to see, do you remember Stephen Spurrier, the wonderful wine man? And he had a vineyard down near Lyme Regis. And I went round his vineyard and I tasted his rosé, which tasted like champagne, and his vintage, which tasted like champagne, and his Blanc de Blanc Chardonnay, which tasted like lemon sherbet, you know, which used to sup out of those wonderful tubes and licorice tubes. And I said to him, which do you prefer? He said, well, it's got to be the Blanc de Blanc. What's the point in trying to be like champagne? We're different soil, we're different people. And so I'm on his side. I think we just got to go our own way. And I think they're doing really, really well.
Although in terms fantastic. Of point, like climate change, Ollie, I mean, I read somewhere that there's obviously a lot of wine growers in Sussex now, aren't there? But in a few years' time, if trends continue, that we'll have a similar climate to that in the middle of France in a matter of decades, right? So in terms of wine cultivation, it will probably change quite quickly here.
I think we're already making fantastic stuff, so I'm really excited. I mean, obviously, you have the normal ones like Nye Timber doing it in a really consistent way. But then you have all sorts of little boys doing it. And it'll be interesting to see all the funny Sauvignon Blancs or funny grape varieties introduced in the 1980s, 1990s. Even they may have their place again, just producing something slightly more Prosecco-ish rather than trying to be champagne.
We mentioned Shakespeare just before there. And of course, you both know that Shakespeare died on the same day as St. George, April the 23rd. So that's, I'm glad that we got that in there. I was going to try and crowbar it in, but you made my life easier. Thinking, Rupert, looking further ahead and thinking about trends now, bearing in mind this is a sobriety podcast as well, how do you see things playing out?
I think on the world of beer, obviously it's easier for beer to go 0% than it is for wine, because we already start at threes or fours quite often. Therefore, it's easier to take the alcohol out, not to brew with the alcohol. So the world of beer, I think, because we've also, rather than just having grapes, or could say grapes with the barrel, we've actually got hops and all these different varieties, which are, I think, even more pronounced than grapes are. So people think they're all hops the same, but I remember going into a pub with Oz Clark and getting him to taste the beer, and I said, what's that? What hops? And he immediately got two American hops, which I'd hardly heard of, which he knew were in the beer. So it's possible to do these things. So I think the hops are amazing. I think you've got your sweetness of the wheat, you've got your barley, you've potentially got oats or flaked oats. You've got so many different, that's even before you get to the yeasts. So I think there are so many bits of artistry to play around with that I think more and more 0% beer is going to be developed in terms of flavour and developed in terms of the number of people who are doing it. So the big boys took time to come back in, but now they're in. So they'll probably publicise it in big volume.
It's great that you mentioned Oz Clark there as well. I've got quite a funny anecdote. For my wife, my then girlfriend, my then fiance, was working at Marks & Spencer, and Oz came along to do a wine tasting thing for Marks & Spencer. And we were going to choose our wedding wine, and Oz and I got on very well. And we must have tried something like 60 different wines that day. And Miley Cyrus had just twerked for the first time, which probably puts a timestamp on it. But we managed to get Oz Clark to twerk during this session. Anyway, needless to say, the wines at the wedding were delightful. So thank you very much for that, Oz Clark. Seth, have you got anything else to ask Rupert?
Yeah, I got like one more sort of historical point that I'd like Rupert to clear up for us. Is it true that English workers were paid... part paid in terms of their wages in beer?
I was thinking about that earlier on today, fun enough, and I've consulted various books, and I consulted the great beer historian Roger Protz, and he was saying the only references he's seen in the past in Britain to people being paid in beer, although paying maybe is the wrong word, is in breweries or in monasteries. So if you think about it all, monasteries in Britain were incredibly important, as was St. Paul's Cathedral before it was burnt down in 1666 and rebuilt by Sir Christopher Wren. So before that time, they were the travelodge or the carriages of their day. They would provide food, they would have fish ponds for fish, and they provide beer. And because they own a lot of the land around, they'd be the ones doing it. So they probably would have given people beer, but not really. It wasn't like the DOPF system in South Africa when people were paid wine for their work. It's not nothing like that. It's more of a sort of monastic tradition than anything else. That's what he thought anyway.
And perhaps finally, Rupert, would you take on more clients who are perhaps catering for the low alcohol, no alcohol market, or that seems to be an interesting market?
I think it's a really interesting market. You know, I think many of the wineries or breweries will do keep to their 12%, 14% of wine or their 4% or 5% in beer. But having an offering at 0% or 0.5%, I think is a very sensible move. And I think it's also, as I say, it's a thing of artistry. If you can make, people always say, even making a lager is very difficult because any fault you have in the lager, people can see. Now, the same is true of 0%. Any fault you have in 0%, damn obvious. So you've got to be really on the pace. But I think with all these wonderful ingredients they can use and the wonderful yeasts, I think the future is going to be extremely exciting.
Well, it's so good to see you, Rupert. It's so lovely to hear your words of wisdom. So thank you for sharing them with us. And we look forward to seeing you again soon.